Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Cochran, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is February 15, 2022. This panel of the court today has five cases on its calendar, two of which will be submitted with oral argument and three of which will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is number A21-771, Dinandan Dobi versus Permar Security Services. I believe counsel are familiar with our standard procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Charles Thomas from Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, representing the relator Dinandan Dobi. May it please the court. The ULJ in this case failed to properly carry out two duties imposed by rule that are essential for an individual to receive a de novo due process hearing. First, the ULJ failed to perform the duty to conduct the hearing as an evidence-gathering inquiry. Specifically, the ULJ did not even attempt to obtain the timesheet that supposedly showed that relator had not recorded accurate times. The transcript shows the ULJ did not ask either party to produce this document. This failure by the ULJ is significant and it prejudiced relator's substantial rights. Relator testified that when writing down his time on the timesheet, he did what the other guards were doing. He did what the supervisor were doing. The timesheet, if it had been gathered into evidence, would likely reveal whether this claim by the relator was accurate. Here's why this is important. The ULJ made a finding that relator was discharged for misconduct, citing 268.095 sub 6A. But 6B of the statute says, regardless of paragraph A, if relator's conduct was conduct that an average reasonable worker would have engaged in under the circumstances, then regardless of the definition and the finding of misconduct, he is not disqualified from benefits. That's the statutory language. So what were the circumstances that relator found himself in? Well, the employer system here really required him to guess and prevented him from accurately recording his times. He did what the other workers were doing. As he said, when we left the guard shack, we had to leave the timesheet there. He couldn't leave because he had to wait for the manager to walk out the store. So built into the employer system is inaccuracy.
Mr. Thomas, before you go further, let me ask. I note that respondent made an argument in their responsive brief that the ULJ is not an advocate for the applicant, that the ULJ has a position of neutrality. And it seems like we have perhaps some difficult line drawing issues here about exactly how the ULJ should conduct the hearing. You say the ULJ should assist the applicant, but does that mean that the ULJ should initiate? On the issue of the timesheet as an exhibit, I mean, is it the ULJ's job or duty to identify that as a beneficial exhibit and suggest it, you know, to take the initiative to identify exhibits that should be gathered, identified, introduced, or merely to respond when the applicant expresses an interest or a wish to introduce an exhibit and then help the applicant accomplish that goal? I mean, there's a difference between those two things. There could be other scenarios in between or on the outer edges, but I'm just asking for some help in trying to understand exactly what the ULJ should do in a situation like this.
The duty, I think, is clear under the rule, not to be an advocate, but to develop the record and to gather the evidence. The system here is set up for the judge essentially to be an inquisitor, to find out what happened. Almost all of these hearings are done pro se. There's nobody there advocating for either party, especially the applicants. So, yes, the judge has to recognize that that's an important exhibit. This isn't advocating for relator, because that timesheet might show that he's not telling the truth. This timesheet could benefit the employer or the claimant. We don't know because it's not there. Rather than having people, yes.
In terms of the importance of the timesheet, though, I don't think there's any dispute that the times he wrote on the timesheet don't exactly match the times that he worked. Is that, would you agree with that in terms of the testimony at the hearing?
Yes, and what he described is that they don't reflect when he, either when he actually left or when he was done working. Again, he didn't know when he left the guard shack when he was going to be done, because that depended upon other people doing their jobs and saying, we're leaving now. So he was put in a position of guessing. This is where we get into the circumstances. Again, the judge did not really inquire about this. The timesheet is not just relator's timesheet. What he said is everybody signs the same piece of paper. So that's going to reveal, were all the workers doing the same thing? Was the supervisor Alex doing the same thing? What would an average reasonable worker do? Would he go along with, this must be the practice that we do here? Or would he be exemplary? Would he say, oh, I'm going to blow the whistle on this? Again, we're talking about average. We're not talking about exemplary or super sensitive. So that, there's a gap here. We don't know what that is. I think anyone advocating for either side here would say, let's see what that document is. Let's see what's on there. Maybe it won't be revealing, but we're left to guess because the judge didn't do his duty.
Second, can you point us to any case that suggests that the duty to conduct the evidentiary hearing or to conduct the hearing as an evidence gathering inquiry and to fully develop the record requires the ULJ to affirmatively ask for a document of this? You know, I mean, given that there's already testimony on this question, I guess I'm wondering why the ULJ has the duty to ask for a document when there's no dispute in the testimony on this point. So can you help me understand that?
The job is to gather evidence, not to assume that what might be out there is not going to be helpful. That's the distinction. The judge can't assume that's not going to, why do I need that? Did you put your times down inaccurately? Yes. That's not the end of the story. Because if an average reasonable worker would have done exactly the same thing, it doesn't matter that the times are inaccurate.
Does that mean, Mr. Thomas, there is not a published case saying that?
You're right. The cases I would cite would be, I think, the White versus Minnesota physicians does have an unrepresented individual where the judge did not explore her mental health. It was obvious from her testimony and from the employer's testimony that that was a significant issue. I would also cite non-presidential case Gates versus Advanced Web Technologies. It was A21-368. It was decided January 10th of 2022. And in that case, the court said that because the judge did not assist the parties in developing evidence and ensure that relevant facts are developed, they said the ULJ's decision was made upon unlawful procedure. So I would acknowledge there are not a lot of cases that define this. And that's why at the end of this argument, I'm going to ask the court to make a precedential decision defining these duties, because there are hundreds of these, if not thousands of these unemployment decisions being made. Very few of them get to this court. And so if this is good enough for the ULJs, these duties will not be carried out in other cases as well. Again, this is not set up the way our court systems are set up, the way the other administrative agencies have hearings with Office of Administrative Hearings, ALJs. There's a very robust procedure there. It's an adversary proceeding. This is not. Although the statute used to say it is not an adversary proceeding. That was removed some years back, but they did not reassert that it is an adversary proceeding. The judge remains in charge of gathering evidence and assisting the parties who may not recognize what the law is, what their claims are, or that they have a defense. That's the system that we need to operate into, that this court, I guess, as an error correcting court, needs to identify. This was an error. Here's how you don't do that again. That's really the court's job.
Counsel, you argue that, just kind of following up on your argument here, You argue that these timesheets are necessary to show what other employees were recording and whether a reasonable employee would conduct themselves in this manner. Deed argues that because the time was inaccurate, it doesn't really matter what other employees were doing. Can you respond to that argument?
Yes. And what that does is that ignores subdivision 6B. I'm not here arguing that putting down wrong times in your timesheet is not misconduct. I'm not making that claim. The statute says, here's the definition of misconduct. Regardless of 6A, the following are not. And so that's why the judge can't just stop there. It's not just the other workers. It was a supervisor that he was following that said he was doing the same thing. There's a second part to this case where the claimant finally was given a chance to say, why were you fired? Here's why I was fired. And he described where the supervisor, Alex, made comments to him that he felt reflected badly on him, on his attire, and as a black man. He objected. He talked back to the supervisor. And then he got fired. So the judge did not explore this either. The judge asked one question of the supervisor, of the HR person for the employer. There was no exploration of whether she actually had the personal knowledge or even the institutional knowledge to answer that question. He said, do you know whether Alex has done this? No. Well, that doesn't mean he didn't do it. That just means she hadn't prepared. Someone else was involved. Again, we don't know. But if he was discharged because Alex and Colin got together and say, look, he's falsifying his timesheet when everyone else is doing the same thing, then it was false that he was discharged for that reason. That's why the judge had to have explored this as well. The judge can't just presume there's nothing there for me to go after. I don't have to explore this. Again, that may be not a comfortable position for a judge to find themselves in, to have to pull out information from parties. But that's what the model is the legislature has set up here. It is unusual, but that's why it's important that an error be pointed out and say, this did not meet the standard that's set in the rule. And the rule is clear. These rules have been around for decades. And so it's important that the parties, not just in this case, but the other ULJs be instructed, here's how this is carried out. There's no other internal review within Deed. It's just this one ULJ. There's no other way to go within the department and get a decision. This is not a case.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes, Counsel.
On the second issue, did Mr. Dobie cross-examine? Well, first of all, did Mr. Dobie have an opportunity to cross-examine the employer representative, or was he expressly told of his opportunity to cross-examine her, after he had testified about his belief about the pretextual reason? And did he do so?
Your Honor, I don't know that he was reminded before at the end of his testimony. He did ask a question of the employer. The employer refused to answer. And that was the end of his question. He asked, isn't it true that this Alex was fired? The employer's representative said, I can't answer that.
That question was asked by the ULJ or by Mr.
Dobie? No, that was asked by Mr. Dobie. And again, there was no follow-up. There was, again, it's true. Mr. Dobie was not very well trained in how to marshal facts, in how to present a case, in how to describe a pretext discharge. But that's what this system deals with, is people who are not trained, who are not sophisticated, who are thrown into a process where if the judge just says, what have you got to tell me? People don't know what's relevant. That's why as lawyers, we explore with clients and help prepare their testimony. This is a pro se case. The record is what the record is. And it would be nice if some things were fleshed out.
Would you say, Mr. Thomas, that by the ULJ's asking a few questions of the employer witness, was that helpful to Mr. Dobie? And was that better? Was that scenario as it happened better than the scenario in which the ULJ asked no questions of the employer representative?
You know, it's hard to draw a line between those two. if I read the judge's questions, they're not clear. They're confounding and compound, and then he gets one word answers. No. Well, that's anyone asking questions who's had some training, no, that's not the way to do it.
Of the transcript, Mr. Thomas, was that the employer's witness didn't know much of anything of her personal knowledge and she was maybe surprised that she was getting the call and had to pull up a file on a computer or something like that.
That's what it looked like to me. And again, that's even makes it even more important for the judge to carry out that evidence gathering function. Usually employers are more prepared. In my experience in doing these hearings, usually they've got someone who can tell a nice, consistent chronological story rather than a more jumbled up story from a claimant. Often that is cited as you're more credible. So the judge's duty applies to both parties, and that's the Vassie versus Schmitty Bus Company case. I see that my time is done, and I'll reserve now till rebuttal.
I have one more short question for you, Mr. Thomas. With respect to part one of your brief, is that argument based solely on the absence of the timesheet from the record? Or in other words, that seems to be your focus, if the ULJ had met his duty, then the record would have included the timesheet. But is there other evidence that you assert would have, should have been gathered and made part of the record in part one of your argument?
I think the information about that timesheet, and is it correct that the other guards were doing the same thing? Was the supervisor doing the same thing? Does that, because it's one piece of paper, according to the employer and according to Mr. Dobie. So that document is going to prompt more questions. And so by not developing the record on what were the circumstances this worker found himself in, did he act reasonably? Or did he act within an average range of what a reasonable worker would do? That part was not explored by the ULJ. It does not even appear in the decisions. And so that's why that job was not done.
Might I ask one additional question? I realize time is out.
Yep. Yeah. Yes. Go ahead, Judge Rodenberg.
Mr. Thomas, would you be so kind for my benefit on rebuttal? You're indicating that you think we should issue a precedential opinion. On rebuttal, I'd be interested to hear, and for Mr. Allen, I'd be interested to hear when he makes his principal comments on whether it should be a presidential opinion. And if so, what should the syllabus point be? Well, in other words, I understand what you're saying, but what would be the precedent in one or two sentences?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and your client and begin your argument. You're muted right now.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lawson Allen, attorney for respondent, Department of Employment and Economic Development in this matter. The issue before the court today is just the separation issue, whether the applicant was discharged because of employment misconduct. And the facts or questions of facts is determined by the judge. But the question of law is whether the issue or the standard of employment misconduct is substantially supported by the evidence here in this case.
Mr. Allen, I don't think that issue, as I understand the relator's brief, I don't think that issue has been placed in issue. In other words, the evidence supporting the finding of misconduct or whether on given facts that conduct is misconduct. It seems to me that the two issues briefed by relator are procedural in nature, and they both challenge the ULJ's manner of conducting the hearing, whether the ULJ gathered enough evidence, provided enough assistance with respect to two questions, the first being the misconduct question, the second question being pretext.
And with respect, with all due respect, Your Honor, I guess with respect to the legal conclusion of employment misconduct, I guess where I'm going with this, the substantial evidence as gathered by the ULJ supports that conclusion. The ULJ did not err in an evidentiary gathering form or did not err in failing to develop a record. The record is developed by the ULJ, supports that legal conclusion of employment misconduct.
Again, I think that I don't think there's any question about the record that we have, whether the record that we have supports the finding of misconduct. I think the question is whether the record should have been developed further. And if it had been developed further, then Relator's counsel is arguing that there might have been a different result with additional evidence. But it seems to me, and you know, I stand to be corrected if I've misinterpreted the Relator's brief, but I feel like that those are the issues that you should respond to.
The record, I guess, to focus on the time cards, the reason the ULJ did not request the time cards is because Mr. Dobie's testimony did not dispute inaccurate reporting of his time actually worked. Mr. Dobie testified, and this is on page 20 of the transcript, that he recorded his departure time prior to departing. On page 21, he testified that his departure time varied daily because of the nature of his final task of the day, and testified that he reported his time in advance of departure because he had a habit or an occurrence of failing to accurately report his time or record the time before departing. Now, the judge...
doesn't the transcript also reflect that he wasn't taught or trained on how to fill out the timesheet, and that others who were working at the same time, and the another person and the supervisor who were working at the same time knew of the practice, and I think he suggested they also did the same thing. So why weren't the time cards necessary to have a complete record as to whether this conduct was something that an average reasonable employee would have engaged in under the circumstances?
The standard, I believe, is satisfied because Mr. Dobie realizes, as evidenced by his behavior, that he is compensated for the time he reports. And the reason Mr. Dobie engages in the practice, through his own testimony, of reporting his time, departure time before he leaves, is because he feels as though he may not have been fully compensated for the amount of time he worked after leaving the guard shack. That demonstrates an understanding that he's compensated for the amount of time actually worked. It also, in Mr. Dobie's testimony, does not dispute that he is, Mr. Dobie's testimony, I think, is clear that he's not told that he can't report his time or record his time in this meeting. Mr. Dobie does not testify that he's told that he should report or record his time in advance of departing, even if that report is inaccurate. And Mr. Dobie also testifies that he had a practice of emailing the lead supervisor his actual time of departure that he suspended because he often forgot to send the email. Mr. Dobie testifies that he is the last security guard to depart. My understanding, review of the transcript and the issue, is that Mr. Dobie works in a security guard shed. That point in the shift, the shed is locked. That is where the time cards are housed. After Mr. Dobie departs the guard shack, he is unable to access it. For that reason, he's unable to write the exact time when he departs. He moves from the guard shed to a Menards facility. He's not permitted to depart, or shift is not over to depart the Menards facility until after Menards employees depart. For this reason, it's impossible for him to accurately record his time on the timesheet, which is locked in the guard shack. But it does not prevent him from emailing his supervisor and securing or ensuring that he's paid for the amount of time he has actually worked prior to departing.
Mr. Allen, yes. There are at least two points in the transcript where it appears to me that Mr. Dobie was indicating that he had other evidence available. On page two, on pages one and two, he's talking about a witness, and he's saying, I didn't know if I'm going to need the witness for sure. And then the judge says, so not for now. And then he, having been led to say that, then Mr. Dobie says, not for now, I guess. A couple pages later, Mr. Dobie is, this is on page three now, I have recordings as well as emails and things like that. How would I give it to you? Someone unidentified, Emily, says, how may I help you? And then they kind of go into some other discussion. And then again on page four, Mr. Dobie says, I have information like evidence or basically whatever, like recordings. And the judge says, we'll worry about it later. Why are those references not sufficient to trigger an evidence gathering inquiry by the ULJ?
The ULJ operates on Mr. Dobie's testimony, which is that he does not dispute submitting inaccurate time reports. And the ULJ at that point has sort of what is necessary to reach a finding of employment misconduct. He's got an inaccurate.
Except, I guess my question is not whether the record is adequate as it's constituted. My question is, aren't those sort of off ramps to explore Mr. Dobie's desire to call witnesses or produce some exhibits, and he's sort of put off and said, oh, we'll worry about that later. Why shouldn't the ULJ have said, okay, hold it a minute. What are those documents? What emails would they be? Who would you like to call? Those seem like questions that would naturally occur to a fact finder on that record.
The ULJ has, when he has undisputed testimony of time fraud, the record that is necessary to reach the legal conclusion. One thing that the ULJ may be balancing is what is gained by prolonging a procedure when the end result is not disputed, that time fraud or inaccurate time reporting has occurred. Mr. Dobie does not dispute that. And there is published case law, Stassen versus Lawn Mountain Truck Leasing, that we cite to in our brief on page 12, that relieves the ULJ of more extensive fact-finding or evidentiary gathering if the evidence is going to be repetitious. In this case, that would be the case.
Well, until you see whatever the exhibits were going to be or whatever he was referring to, how would you know that it's going to be repetitive?
Well, the ULJ has, with undisputed time fraud or time theft, the fact that is necessary to reach the conclusion of employment misconduct. The court has held in many cases that even moderate or de minimis theft is, in a single occurrence, is employment misconduct.
To be
Once
sure.
Once that fact is.
What if the emails, we haven't seen them. We don't know what's in the emails. What if the emails were back and forth between he and Alex and someone, Alex or someone else told him, yeah, don't worry about it. It's just a few minutes. We'll correct that later. What if that was the email?
There is no testimony to that effect. And to go to your earlier question, Your Honor, Mr. Dobie was permitted the opportunity to cross-examine the employer's representative. Mr. Dobie has not submitted that evidence on request for reconsideration, which would have been another opportunity or another offering, so to speak, for the unemployment law judge to ask for a second audience.
He had the opportunity to question the witness for sure, but would you agree that the witness didn't have any personal knowledge of what happened?
That is my read of the transcript.
Right. So cross-examination at that point is going to be kind of difficult. She's just looking at some records that he hasn't seen.
I don't know that Mr. Dobie never saw the discharge letter, but we don't know what records she was reviewing during the course of the hearing.
Right. I guess we agree on that.
Mr. Allen, can you give us an example of an instance where you think the ULJ would have a duty to seek additional information to develop the record fully?
As counsel referred, in the Wyatt issue that they cite to, there was clear evidence of mental illness that was not explored. Mental illness conduct as a consequence of mental illness may be a standing to not find employment misconduct. And that was referred to in the course of that hearing. What distinguishes this instance is that the time theft, the time fraud was fully explored and not disputed from the end.
Well, was it really fully explored where the employer's witness really didn't have much knowledge of the situation and, in terms of the conduct of other employees who were working at the same time?
I think, Your Honor, yes, it was. Mr. Dobie's testimony is that he reported on his time card an average departure time because he did not know in advance when he would leave. Mr. Dobie does not testify that he was told that he could inaccurately report his time. Mr. Dobie testifies that he was not told he couldn't report his time in advance. There's a dispute as to whether Mr. Dobie was ever given a warning about it. But the findings upon which the judge reaches his conclusion are substantially supported, that Mr. Dobie never received explicit permission to inaccurately report his time. Mr. Dobie never argues that he does, and Mr. Dobie inaccurately reported his time, resulting in him being compensated for time he did not work. Those points were not disputed. Those points are full.
Mr. Allen, a relator's counsel has called our attention to subdivision 6 of 0.095, which defines misconduct. And it has two parts. 6A says, serious violations of standard of behavior, that language. And 6B says, regardless of paragraph A, the following is not misconduct. And there's 10 examples. In a sense, those are exceptions, I guess. Does the ULJ's duty differ when there's evidence that might be relevant to paragraph A as opposed to paragraph B? Or maybe I should reverse my question. Is the ULJ's duty any different if the applicant has invoked or referred to facts that might satisfy one of the exceptions in paragraph B, even if the evidence relating to paragraph A is unaffected?
He has in his brief on page 14 a string cite that indicates that other employees, former coworkers, compliance or deviance from policies should not be consideration in reaching a finding of employment misconduct. Here, I think that the unemployment law judge is tasked with the sole objective of finding whether the applicant's conduct is the conduct an average reasonable employee would engage in under the circumstances. And that is demonstrated by the applicant. No, the applicant, Mr. Dobie, knew that he was not being compensated for the time he worked, and he took measures to rectify that, meaning he would get paid for all the time that he did work. And Mr. Dobie had means available to him to be compensated for exactly the amount of time he worked through an email to his supervising security officer, which he suspended doing. Mr. Dobie understood. Mr. Dobie took steps to realize it. Mr. Dobie suspended those steps.
Your time has expired. You may sum up if you wish.
In the present case, the unemployment law judge fully developed a record to reach the legal conclusion, prolonging or suspending, continuing for the gathering of time cards to support the undisputed testimony that time theft occurred. Is not necessary in this instance because the issue was fully explored and addressed by the employment law judge's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Mr. Thomas, as noted earlier, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. I think that counsel's argument shows why there needs to be a decision enforcing these duties. What Mr. Allen described is that the judge gets enough evidence to reach a decision on misconduct and then stops. That's not where the statute stops. And that's not where the judge's duty under the rule to gather evidence can stop. A couple of separate points. I don't believe the record shows that there was any emailing of timesheets between the relator and the employer. He does describe being requested to take a picture and text it to the employer on one occasion. He talks about emails, but I don't think those were in the context of the timesheet. One other point.
Is it correct, Mr. Thomas, that to this day, we don't know what's in the emails that he was referring to?
No. Again, he did not have counsel. He did not make a proffer at reconsideration, although he actually, the judge in the reconsideration decision, identified that he made four arguments. So he did say, this is not the real reason I was fired, these other things. So the judge knew what he was saying. I think one point I want to emphasize, and that is that under the standard of review, relayer does not have to prove to this court that there has been error or that he's been prejudiced. The statute says if his substantial rights may have been prejudiced, and that's really the situation we are when we don't have a complete record. We can see there's a gap here. He might have done better if that had not been there. There's evidence that was not gathered. Maybe that would have changed the outcome. So that may, that's really the reason why there needs to be reversal here. I think that what I would ask the court to write, if the court writes a presidential opinion, is that the ULJ's duty to gather evidence and to fully and clearly develop the record includes identifying issues and gathering evidence even when a party does not recognize their relevance. This includes when there is a defense, if that's the word, or an exception that makes the actions not misconduct. That's not a very concise version, but I think that is the importance of this judge's duty.
Mr. Thomas, if you're moving to a new topic, I don't want to interrupt you finishing your last point. But I mean, you've done a good job in this case of highlighting how this hearing was not ideal, not perfect. But obviously we don't have anything in the record about the entire big picture, but I think we have a general understanding that the department gets thousands and thousands of applications every year and then gets requests for reconsideration, leading to probably thousands of these evidentiary hearings. ULJs, you know, the department and the ULJs have finite resources. And at some point, people need to get the job done as best they can in the time allowed. I mean, if we take your arguments to their logical conclusions, it seems like perhaps every evidentiary hearing would be twice as long. And then we would need to either double the resources or we would only get half as much done, the department, that is. How do you balance the requirements of the statutes, our goals and ideals, with the reality that we have finite resources?
So I've been doing these cases for a long time. And when I first started doing these cases, the law said the employer has the burden of proving misconduct because the employer fired the person. They must know why they did it. If you quit, the worker has the burden of justifying why that was a good reason. And so the hearings, like other adversary proceedings, required a party to bring their evidence. The judge was not made to be an inquisitor, did not have the duty to gather evidence. Now, the legislature's changed that. And again, it might be a burden to operate under the system that the legislature has created. Deed has a way to respond to that. They're at the legislature almost every year changing the bill. So if this is too burdensome to do the job that has been set up, then they can try to change that. All we can do is operate on the system that we've got. This telephone hearing that the claimant gets is the only opportunity an individual applicant has to challenge a decision that may involve thousands of dollars of benefits, either that they have been denied or that the department is not going to take back as an overpayment. So these are really crucial. It's supposed to be a due process de novo hearing. And this court, I think, needs to instruct the department. These duties need to be carried out. They're in the rules. Gather the evidence, assist parties when they don't know what they're doing, and then reach a good result. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its written opinion within 90 days.